Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Speaking Insights. I'm your humble host, Des Thornton. Our co-host, Kelly Vandiver, the lovely Kelly Vandiver, is not here with us today, unfortunately. She's a little bit under the weather, and so I'm going to try to take up the slack for Kelly. Big shoes to fill today, but I'm going to give it my best shot. And we are fortunate today to have in the studio with us Mrs. Jennifer Conweiler, PhD, CSP. And for those of you who don't know what that CSP means, it's Certified Speaking Professional. And we'll get a little bit more into that later today, but just means that this lady has put in a ton of work to earn that designation, and we'll learn all about her journey to get there. Now, behind the scenes, we've been trying to land this interview with Jennifer for some time, but she has been so busy crisscrossing the globe that we are fortunate to have her here today. So, Jennifer, welcome.
Oh, Des, it's my pleasure. I've been listening and wishing I could be here, so I'm so happy to have the day with you today, or at least less than an hour.
Yes. So we're so fortunate. I know you're busy, and again, we appreciate you taking the time to do this. And what I envision is us taking a journey through your ascent, and I know you don't like that word, but your ascent in the speaking business. So let's start by trying to figure out, how did you get into the business?
Well, you know, one good thing, Des, about getting older is you have a couple of different strands of your story that you could tell. But to put it simply, I started out more in training and working in higher ed and having my own business and consulting. And I was doing a lot of that stand-up training. So there's a story behind that, just in terms of honing your skills over years and years. And as time went on, I realized that I was getting pretty good at it, but I wanted to reach a broader audience. Right. You know, I was going in for these 3 or 4 day gigs. And so I would work with different companies and got a boatload of experience in so many different industries and working in all kinds of groups that you were either open to training and not. So I learned how to handle resistance. And so I got pretty good at it. And then I decided, you know, I heard about this world of speaking. So I checked that world out. And that's kind of how I morphed into that arm of the business, from really moved in from a world of corporate training and doing consulting into that. So it was kind of interesting, because I was, the first time I heard about speaking, somebody told me about NSA Georgia, and I went. It was probably about 15 years ago, and I went to a meeting, and what did I see? There were all these really nice guys in suits walking around.
Right.
And I didn't really get it, and I didn't see myself at that time as what the main purpose or the main focus of speaking was, which was kind of motivational Tony Robbins type speaking. Everybody wanted to be him. And I decided I couldn't really find a place for myself, but that changed over time, which was really great. Opportunities opened up.
Yes, obviously, and we'll learn a lot about that. If you don't mind me asking, what type of training are you doing for corporate, just so that we have some insight about that and how it may connect to what you're doing today?
Sure. Well, I did what they used to call soft skills training. Okay. Right now they say soft skills leads to hard results.
Right.
So, but it used to be things like leadership development, change management. We would come in. I worked for instance, at GE, and I worked for them for several years, and we would come in and do a 5-day program. This was very typical for what I would do. And then I would co-train with my other facilitators doing those soft skills and helping people not just learn about, you know, how to work your project, but how to really get it accepted and how to lead the project. So I developed a lot of courses in that. I delivered it. And I also had a counseling background. I had gotten my doctorate in that. So I was doing a lot of coaching before coaching got kind of really big.
Sounds like you were really doing the speaking and everything that it entails before you took on the title of speaker. Sounds like you had a strong foundation there.
Exactly. But I kind of had to get over that sort of barrier within myself to really call myself a speaker. It was interesting because I came more at it from the sort of counseling, sort of facilitation.
Right.
And I later, the great thing about our profession now is that it embraces all those arms.
You absolutely.
Know, right.
Absolutely.
So, but back then I couldn't really get my arms around speaking. And now I definitely say to people, I'm a professional speaker. And I'm proud of it.
Well, our listening audience is a wide range, from aspiring speakers to some seasoned speakers like yourself. And so I'm curious to know, once you sort of officially took on the label of speaker. What was it like those first couple of years when you were officially in the speaking business? I know a lot of times that there's some uncertainties and some anxieties that go along with those things. So I'm curious to know what that was like getting started.
Well, there were positives and there were negatives. I mean, I think, and actually it was more of a gradual kind of transition when I actually stepped into the words of speaker, you know, and call myself a speaker. But I think for me, the positives were that I still kept my model of working in collaboration with consulting firms, with other trainers. So I did a lot of group work. And that's where the opportunities were.
Right.
I did a lot of outplacement training when companies were laying off. So I got a lot of experience doing that. And so that part still worked for me because it helped me diversify my business. So if one firm wasn't getting a lot of business, I'd get a call from another one.
Right.
Yeah, so I learned that model. That really worked.
Yeah,
that
worked. Like that's a lasting strategy, something that could still be implemented today.
It is. But I always laugh because my husband, Bill, who has the bird's eye view, we just celebrated our 41st anniversary yesterday, which is hard to believe, but he always laughs. He's you don't take yourself too seriously with your family, right?
Right.
they put you in your place
you,
fast.
Yes.
But one of the things I remember him doing, when we moved to Atlanta, I would brag to people that I could get around anywhere because I was working in so many different places. And you asked about the hard part of it. And he'd pull out all these business cards and he'd say, well, where do you work? Who are you? You know, it was like every single Marietta. It was like all over the place, you know. So that part of it, I would say, was the challenging part, too, because I didn't really feel when I was speaking that I really had a niche or an identity.
Right.
I felt like, yeah, so what? I knew leadership. I had my advanced degree. You know, I worked at these great companies, but I was still, you know, a leadership speaker like a million other people. So I felt like that was the challenging part of it.
Understood. So I guess I was going to ask you, and you sort of alluded to this, is how did you resolve that problem and or that challenge? And you spoke about niching, so that's something that we'll certainly speak about later. Just in terms of anecdotally, during that time period of transition, which doesn't seem like it was a hard transition for you, was there one particular instance or something that stuck out, even if it were in your training experience before you officially took on the label as speaker, where you remember sort of this one thing as we typically have as a beginner, sort of that kind of moment that sticks with us and we never forget?
Yeah. And by the way, I love listening to the other speakers. If anyone's hearing this, make sure you check out the other recordings you guys have done with Martha Lanier and Waldo and all the people. They have such great stories, you know. And so as I think of one, the one that always comes back to me is when I was working with IBM and they were doing their first big downsizings. And I was working for another third-party contractor that, as I said, that was my model. And so, you know, I walked into this room of pretty much 50 white male engineers. Maybe there was one woman in the group. But in any case, and there they were ready to pretty much do battle.
Wow.
You know, IBM was not a company that let go of people. And here I was, and don't shoot the messenger, but boy, they did. And I remember one guy literally throwing a notebook. And it reminded me of my days as a substitute teacher. And,
wow.
In middle school, when kids would throw desks, you know,
right.
At least this wasn't a desk. And I thought, oh my God. And here's what happened. I was so overwhelmed. I mean, I remember I said, let's take a break. And because that's all I knew to do. And I went in the other room and there was an extra room in there. And I'm like crying and my stomach is like doing a million flip flops. And I don't know how I got through the rest of the day, but I did. But when I met with the guy who was actually coaching me, I didn't like what he had to hear, but he said, you know, you really need to get this together. He said, you're going to get a lot of this resistance. And I don't want resistance. I don't want people
to
like me.
No,
but here's what happened. The big lesson I learned there was sometimes you throw the script away, Des. You know?
Right. Absolutely.
You know, they kept pushing back and this guy, they were angry and what they wanted to do is just vent. And as soon as I could learn that I could really need to listen to where the group is, you know, still get back to script when I could, but be able to put it aside. With my own, you know, sense of confidence up there. That's all they were looking for, the chance to express themselves. And that lesson, I'll tell you, I've pulled that out umpteen times. And after that, I wasn't as fearful that they wouldn't like me or the material or anything like that. It was a huge lesson for me back then.
I think that's always huge with facilitation, is kind of having the pulse of the group. And as the word that you mentioned, confidence, is having that confidence to kind of flow with the group for just a second before you get back to the script. And I'm sure you probably experienced that same thing on the platform speaking. You know, we prepare the speech and prepare the speech. And it's like when you actually get on to deliver the speech, the energy may be different or something may have been said in the introduction that totally changes that. And you have to have that confidence to just kind of be in the moment and flow with it. So
you got it.
Admire you for that.
No, well, I will admire you too. I've seen you present a million times, and I love, not a million times, but I wish I could have. But you're absolutely right. I remember co-presenting one time with this woman, Donna, and she literally, the PowerPoint didn't work, and she flipped out. She flipped out, and I said, I will never do that.
Right.
You know, like, forget the PowerPoint. You just go with the flow. The play goes on, you know, and luckily, I'm a very flexible, that's my personality is flexible, but I could, but somebody said to me the other day, she said, you know, I watched a speaker and I winced for that person. Mm-hmm. I was feeling so uncomfortable because they were uncomfortable and they were unconfident. It's like always good to remember they're watching you.
Right. And you transfer that energy and people
you do.
Tend to forget that. Well, being flexible, obviously, congratulations on 41 years of marriage.
Thank you.
You have to be flexible to make
that's
it that far.
That's where we need the drink in the studio.
Definitely have to be flexible there. And I'd also like to just congratulate you on being a pioneer. I consider you a pioneer in
our
industry, particularly for women and some of the things that you've accomplished. So my hat's off to you for blazing the trails that people like myself and Kelly, who couldn't be with us today, can follow in your footsteps. So let's shift gears a little bit here and get into your niche topic and talk about introverts and extroverts. And for me, that's always sort of a moving target. Mm-hmm. I would consider myself an introvert by nature.
Yes.
And I think the way that I best define it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but basically looking at the place where you get your energy. So do you get your energy from being alone and in your own head, or do you get your energy from being around other people and the conversations and things that are going on there? So first, if you wouldn't mind telling us, you know, sort of your definition of it, and then we'll get a little bit deeper into what being an introvert is all about.
Right. Well, I'm so glad you asked me to talk about my favorite topic. And
of course, asked, that's why I invited you here.
Well, you did a beautiful job of describing it. And the only other thing I would add to that is, like, I like to look at a picture of a battery, you know, a bit, Des, and where do you get your battery charged up?
Mm-hmm.
So an introvert's charged up in solitude, in quiet time.
That's
where they re-energize, where their creative thoughts come, where they can stop. And as you said to me before, I need to decompress and think through how this year went for me as president, you know, to really reflect. The extrovert is talking out their thoughts and getting their energy from other people. And their battery drains when they're alone too much, when they have that too much time without bouncing off ideas.
Wow. Okay. So I was on point. I did my homework.
You totally did.
So let me ask you this. Now, I know you pretty well and glad to have the opportunity to get to know you more here. Now, from me seeing you in public and hearing you speak, I would put you in the extrovert category. So would I be safe in assuming that you're an extrovert who works with introverts, or are you a covert introvert?
A covert who works with introverts. Or you forgot the newest term, ambivert.
Ambivert. Okay, you have to educate me on that one.
Yeah, well, actually, a lot of people say they're ambiverts because it's a sort of a bell curve, you know, so people fall in the middle. So actually, you guessed it right. I do have the energy, and I am an extrovert. On the Myers-Briggs, I test out like that. And so I call myself a champion of introverts because, you know, what happened was for many years, I was working in these organizations and noticed that introverts were oftentimes overlooked and they were ignored and they were really misunderstood. You know, I was in working with technology folks and people in analytical fields like finance, engineering, and they were very frustrated when they couldn't get their ideas heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I kind of married my ability to sort of bring people out and help them with the idea of working with introverts, and they were very appreciative. So I always come at it from a point of I have so much to learn. And the other thing is we have both sides within us, Des.
Right.
So you mentioned you have both. So more and more, I'm doing things like prepare, like my introverted interviewers.
Right.
Too. So I think about it. And boy, wouldn't you know, I mean, actually what you put out there is a little more deep when you think about it, you know, those kind of things. I take quiet time. Now, if you talk to my husband, Bill, he takes this book I have in front of me, The Introvert, and he says, read the book.
Right. Read your own book, right? Take your own medicine.
Exactly. But that's the other thing that influenced me was trying to navigate this marriage that I've got, you know, with an extreme introvert who's not just an introvert. He's also a curmudgeon.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's a great combination.
So you get practice all the time. You have 41 years experience.
All the time. I mean, do not disturb on the door with the lock and then the file cabinet like a teenage boy in front of the door.
Right, right.
Because, you know, and so I have to write my sticky note with my points. And I think a lot of people laugh that, you know, opposites do attract. It's just the work that I'm doing now, or I'm writing in the new book, is about opposite partnerships. It's not just that they attract, but what keeps them together.
Makes sense, because you need both ends of that battery, right?
You really do.
In order to be charged.
And so does the workplace.
So in your work with introverts, is there any particular characteristics that you notice with introverts that sort of open the door for success with them? Or is it some type of trend? Obviously, people are all different, but is there some sort of common thread you see amongst these people? I know you mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of times their voices weren't heard.
Yes.
And so probably a lot of blockage to potential success for companies and organizations because they had these talented people who weren't being heard. So over your years and work with these people, is there some type of consistent maybe personality trait or characteristic, you know, that you notice with these individuals?
In terms of blocking them or being a problem or being a positive
actually,
thing?
Both
I could
sides.
Talk about both.
Yeah, both
yeah.
sides.
Yeah, sure. Because, well, first of all, let's talk about a couple of the challenges that introverts have in typical organizations. You know, we work in type A type of workplaces. So it's, you know, make quick decisions, fast, you know,
right.
sell yourself, talk about who you are, you know, mm-hmm. all the things that, and, you know, express yourself, talk
right.
about things. And so all those things are not really natural to most introverts. You know, they like their privacy. They like to think
yes.
about things. They like to think about decisions.
Yes.
Have to do the first thing off the top of their head. And so that creates some real friction unless you have a team or a manager who really respects differences
mm-hmm.
and accepts that people have different styles
right.
and honors that. And
right.
that's where you see that working. So those are a couple of the challenges. It leads to real disconnects, things like people exhaustion and negative impressions that others have. So you're not talking in the meeting, so therefore you're angry. And
right.
You're plotting, right?
right. You're plotting a coup or something like
exactly.
that, right?
Exactly. I mean, I've heard that literally, Des, out of people's mouths. So those are some of the challenges. But on the other hand, oh my gosh. I mean, and the good news is introverts are starting now to find their voice, and the world is really starting to listen to those quiet influencers, as I call them,
mm-hmm.
the people who listen really well,
right.
who do prepare,
right.
you know, who have what we call focused conversations, where one-on-one they'll talk to you to really understand your point of view
right.
and then share what they think at a deeper level,
right.
you know, and not just, you know, surface. Also, interestingly, what I have found in, and I wrote about this in Quiet Influence, is the social media now being a strength of introverts. The fact that, and when I say it real broadly, like the person who blogs and he doesn't necessarily want to talk to you about it, but he
right.
wants to get your opinions out there. He wants to
Understood.
Engage with people at his time. During his time,
mm-hmm.
you know, how he wants to, and you're making, you're rolling your eyes right now. Is that like an anathema to you? You hate it?
Well, I'm an introvert, and so the whole social media thing, you know, and people in our industry have told me several times, you got to get over it, but it just drives me crazy. And the reason why is being introverted, as you mentioned earlier, and just having that place to recharge. I don't want all the distractions coming in from people saying what they're doing. And so I think for me, it comes down to a matter of control, you know, and having control over it. So if I could have ample control over the social media outlets, then I think is certainly you know, certainly a good thing.
Absolutely. I've got a lot of tips in Quiet Influence on how you can do that. And what most people say is just like 10 minutes a day, you know, pick your platform that you want to work on. To me, it's about learning.
Right.
Like I listen and learn through mm-hmm. Twitter, for instance.
Right.
You know, I post on there, but I really like to see what's going on. That might not be the format for you. But the thing you need to think about in this day and age is one of my millennial friends shared, and he's a member. Ryan has
Ryan
been a member.
Jenkins.
Yeah, Ryan,
yes.
who's in who
no,
Jenkins.
Ryan, very well.
Ryan is a great guy. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and Ryan said to me, you know, Jennifer, if a couple of us in our organization check out a new manager, for instance, and we look him up online and he doesn't have any kind of digital footprint,
right.
we pretty much discount him.
Right.
You
wow.
know, so
yeah.
I don't,
sense.
You know what I mean? It does make, and so nowadays it's sort of not an option in a way. You sort of have to be out there.
Understood.
But I found that the introverts that I know do it really in a very effective way.
Right. Not surprisingly.
Yeah. And other things too mention, you know, a calm demeanor,
mm-hmm.
like everybody's running around during a crisis. There was
right.
a producer I interviewed for one of the books on at CNN who was so respected, extremely introverted, hardly ever spoke. But, you know, she worked in the newsroom,
mm-hmm.
And people would be just like flipping out over this crisis, and then she'd be just so calm
right.
and just keep everybody together. And she was, they have such respect for her, you know, for Kim as an introvert and so many others.
Wow. So I guess bringing this back to the speaking front, obviously those introverts are peppered throughout audiences across the world.
Yeah.
And so what do you suggest, or is there something that as speakers we can do to make sure that we tap into the minds, or at least engage and make that connection with our introverted audience members?
I'm so glad you asked that, because people oftentimes will say to me, I don't know how you speak to introvert audiences. Like, they all sit there like dead, right?
Right. Or probably if they're like me, they have a notebook out taking notes feverishly.
Right. Taking
don't
want
to give any feedback.
I just no response.
Right. I want to take these home and, you know, analyze them.
Exactly. You know, and the speakers, the funny thing is, one of the things that speakers I find do that's not the thing, you're talking about do's and don'ts, what they do that isn't, the crowd gets quiet and they're maybe thinking or who knows what.
Right.
And the more they're quiet, the more we're as speakers revving it up.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's almost like the anti.
Exactly.
Then they get more upset and they're not hearing you. So so that would be the first thing. Just like chill.
Yeah, that's
interesting. Don't try to do a whole song and dance. And just kind of, as you said earlier, you're reading the energy of the group.
Mm-hmm.
So pausing is extremely important. I'm constantly working on that. I'm not a big pauser.
Right.
I just have too much coming out.
Right. Got too much to say, right?
So I like, even when I'm doing webinars, I'll have on my computer pause, you know, count 1, 2, 3. That partly the delay too, but it's also just important to do that.
Yeah.
And it's hard on stage mm-hmm. when they're sitting. So pausing is really key. You know, one thing I found kind of through happenstance, through all those years of training, is you could have very low energy or it feels like that in a room. And then you go, okay, well, you know, turn to your neighbor. And I kind of make a joke about it. I go, how many of you hate those exercises where you have to turn to your neighbor?
My hand is up.
Right. So it's like, okay, now turn to your neighbor and tell them how much you hate it.
Right.
That just came to me one day. You guys can have it. It's like fun. And then, okay, now we're going to talk about this for 1 minute. And what's incredible is the energy, you may have noticed this, Des, the energy goes up.
Right.
Because people who are more introverted do very well in one-on-one, like you and I talking right now.
Absolutely.
Rather than always in the group.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in a large keynote situation, you know, I've got a group I'm talking with next week that's 1,500. That's pretty large for me. I usually do a couple hundred. I need to think that through. I don't want to, you know, that's... You don't want to overuse a technique. Maybe once I'll use that because it's too many people and it gets a little out of control.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have seen that done well. So that's another thing. And I think also another thing that I learned is writing. Like, you could just say to them, okay, what do you think about this? You know, how many of you think that introverts do this? All right. So you ask them, you say, just write down your answer.
Uh-huh.
And so you have them write it down and you don't even have to ask to have them say it. But that way, writing is really one of the strengths of introverts. They think through by writing.
You're confirming my introvertedness over here.
And I think our producer is nodding wildly,
nodding
too,
as well.
Right? So I get that a lot in radio. Not on TV, but anyway. So that's what so writing it down. So just interweaving some of these techniques. And the last thing I'll say is just on a very practical nature, just be really aware of those questions we ask, like, you know, raise your hand if, you know, and stand up if, just kind of keep that. It's okay to do a little bit, but don't overuse it because, you know, you'll turn the introverts off. It's just too much stimuli.
Yeah.
Too much. You know, like,
understood.
You
understood.
So I'm going to find you at the upcoming NSA conference convention. I'll find you on the elevator going up to take breaks to your room, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's funny. I do that. So I'm very much guilty of that. Well, one thing I'm interested in, and this is kind of a personal question here. So I'm curious to know if there is a person that would be, I guess, somewhat iconic, somebody that would be recognizable, who would be an introvert that we would have no idea this person is considered an introvert. And where I'm going here is most sort of musical geniuses and people of that ilk. And I would even include myself here, you know, being a speaker, my family, my grandmother, for example, she's like, that's the last thing that I would think you would do is get up and be a speaker. But I think that's, you know, when I'm on the platform, that's sort of the extroverted side of me, that side of my battery. So is there anyone that, I mean, maybe you've worked with and we don't know, but just some person who would be an introvert, but we would assume just based on their status as an extrovert?
Yeah, oh, that's a great question. Well, a lot of the executives, like the new executive of GM, Mary Barra, is a real introvert. She's
really
talked about that. Janet Yellen, I'm mentioning women, who's the new Federal Reserve chair.
Mm.
But Barack Obama a lot of people would probably guess. I don't know if they would guess he's an introvert.
I would probably guess that.
Many people have said Hillary Clinton, if we talk about politicians. You asked for one. I'm just giving
you
a few.
No, I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. I was just curious about that.
Because... And actually, most comedians and most actors
mm-hmm.
are introverted.
Yeah.
And it's very, who was I listening to? Oh, there's a guy named Jonathan Rauch who wrote a wonderful piece in The Atlantic a number of years ago. He was one of the first articles on introversion. And he said, he's basically said, we're so used to acting that when actors get up there and act, might have not been Jonathan Rauch. I take that back. It might have been somebody else I was listening to recently who said, actors are so used to it that it's just one part of the way they perform. And so many people say comedians, most of them are. Jay Leno, Johnny Carson was.
Yeah, and I mean, Richard Pryor is one of my favorites, and I'm being a little revealing here, but I understood that he was an introvert in a lot of ways. And just from, you know, what we know of him, that's certainly not a person that you would probably put in that category.
You're absolutely right.
So I guess it's one of those things where you can't judge a book by its cover.
No.
You know, when it comes to the introvert, extrovert deal. So shifting gears one more time here to talk a little bit about just your business model and your speaking and your writing. Obviously, you've been successful at this, and you said that your normal audience is about 1 to 200. So one of my questions was, you know, who is in your typical audience? So if we were to survey people in your typical audience, is it still people who would come from your training background where it started, sort of corporate environment leaders? You know, is it more community organization type people? And I know that you've done some international work as well. And so I guess I'm just curious to know, you know, with such a niche topic, who would we typically find in your audience?
Yeah, well, I have a couple of areas that my audience is. And actually, my typical audience is usually more like 400, 500. Not that makes any difference at all, but in a way it does in terms of how you deliver stuff.
Absolutely.
You know?
I can appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. So where I find that I get more most interest is a couple of areas. One is associations. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I mentioned the one coming up, the Library Association. I'm talking to some of their divisions. Another is I work quite a bit with large government entities like or quasi-government, like the Federal Reserve. I did one at Freddie Mac last week. And those are people who are analytical people, insurance companies will call me, you know, where people are primarily introverts.
Right.
So that will be who's in the audience.
Understood.
So that's,
that makes sense, too, being that you speak to introverts.
Yeah. Yeah, that would
better have those people in the audience.
They seem to be appreciative. They seem to be very appreciative of that.
Understood. And being an introvert myself, I can imagine that being in your audience, obviously the times that I've heard you speak, it's been in front of NSA, you know, our NSA family. So it's a totally different context in terms of the speaking. But, you know, I can imagine that it's sort of a sacred kind of ground when you're there with all those introverted people and the way that you have to manage them. I can just imagine you speaking to a room full of Desmonds with their notebooks there. And it's like, we don't want to raise our hands. We just want to, you know, suck your brain dry for everything that you know so that we can take it back and analyze. So I commend you on having the patience to do.
Thank you. And I look at it as a challenge and I love it. I just, to me, the greatest compliment that I can get from a group is if they say to me at the end of the session, they say, does everybody get along this well in your groups? You do? I'm like, yeah, well, I think, you know, part of my, I guess I would say my gift or my calling is to sort of bring people out and show them what gifts they have and that they, you know, they don't have to change who they are.
Right, right. So let me ask you, how, in terms of the audiences that you speak to, how does that work come about? You know, obviously it's from relationships to some extent, but for those who are listening and, you know, trying to break into associations or maybe to do government work, obviously you've been doing this for a long time, so I know that you have relationships.
Yeah.
But for those people who are either, you know, seasoned speakers trying to get into this industry or either newer speakers who are just trying to break in for the first time, you know, what types of tips would you have for them in terms of, you know, breaking into this sector?
Okay, well, don't underestimate the power of the one-on-one relationship. I want to share just a brief story that happened. I was at and then I'll answer the rest of your question. I was at a large conference for the HR group SHRM, you know, a couple of years ago. And about a year or so later, a woman who was at my session called me and asked me to come and talk to her organization, which is part of NASA, actually. And so when she was dropping me off at the airport, I said, Heather, you know, I know you were at the, you heard me speak. I said, well, what made you hire me? Why did you bring me in?
Right.
And she said, well, Jennifer, your speech was good. I liked your speech, but that wasn't why I hired you. And I said, well, you know, she really piqued my curiosity right. then. I'm like, what?
Right, because you're looking, how can I repeat this, right?
Exactly. And so, right. And so she said, no, it was afterwards at your book signing. Mm-hmm. And she said, at the book signing, I had a lot of books. I bought a bunch of books and I had a bunch of them signed. She said, but you looked up at me and you asked me about what I did and asked me about my challenges, et cetera, you know. Right. So that's what she remembered.
Right, because you made it personal.
I made it personal. And it was just, again, that connection. And that wouldn't have, I would never have said that was what I was intentionally doing, you know? So that's what I, first of all, want to say. Don't underestimate, you know, anytime you go to a meeting. I got a really good assignment at the CDC a few years ago because I sat next to somebody at a professional meeting that didn't even have anything to do with speaking.
Right.
You know, and so just even, I know introverts hate being on talking on planes. So if there's any introverts, I'm not encouraging you to do that. Put the headphones
that's
on,
right.
But you never know who you'll meet. And a lot of our speaker friends will say that. So that's one thing. And that's not, you know, a plan of attack, but it's, to me, it's very, very key, that engagement and that connection.
Right.
I also spoke a lot. I think it does two things, you know, for free.
Mm-hmm.
Or my friend Sharon Jordan Evan calls it marketing opportunities.
Right. I think I have a friend who calls it a promotional speaking.
Promotional speaking.
I
think it's good. It kind of reframes it in your head.
It does.
Especially when you're starting out, as you said, a challenge. You know, you're not making much money. You're like, oh my God.
Right.
So you want to leverage that. And so, you know, you take gigs, and a lot in the beginning, you take a lot of gigs. And partly because what this one coach got me to realize early on, I actually was getting some coaching. I believe a lot in getting coaching. And she said to me, she wasn't a speaker, but she said, what you're saying, Jennifer, is you said you want to get more work from the work that you do.
Right.
And that just nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like basic, but I put that up on my wall. And I said, that was my goal, to get really good at speaking, so that whenever people hired me, I had a good opportunity to get rehired somebody who was there. And then as time went on, you know, I was a little more selective of the programs that I did say yes to that were free.
Right. Well, I certainly thank you for the nugget of the one-on-one. You know, that's one of those intangible things that, you know, you don't really find in a marketing book or something like that. It's one of those things that comes from experience. So I certainly appreciate you sharing that. And obviously you've been...
And I'm going to throw one at you, Jez, because of that. As the follow-up, social media comes in. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
absolutely.
Like that person you met, then you say, let's link in.
Right.
See?
I
and then you can start that dialogue with them.
So you're going to do this to me too, right?
I'm going
to
do it. You're not just the conduit for these ideas. You're going to try some of these on, right?
Yeah, and Tricia Malloy, who's normally our producer, who's not here today, she would be egging you on right now because she's one of those people who's always encouraging me in that area.
Oh.
Well, obviously you've done so well at the one-on-one relationships, and as you said, just kind of doing the promotional speaking, that it's now expanded across U.S. borders, and you're doing some international work. So talk to us a little bit about the work that you're doing internationally, because I know a lot of, obviously the world is getting smaller and smaller, and so all speakers are looking at doing things beyond the borders of the U.S. So maybe some of the groups or organizations that you're working with abroad, and you know, if your area of interest or your focus is the same with them as they are with, you know, people in the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to give a plug to NSA, first of all, for that National Speakers Association, for sort of helping me figure out my direction there and realize how much I didn't know about speaking internationally. Just a little background. When my first book came out, I wrote a book in HR in 2005, but that really wasn't aligned with my business. It was a major publisher. I co-wrote it with husband Bill and on HR. But then in 2007, I started on The Introverted Leader, and that came out in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And when that came out, that was all part of my approach and my strategy to get more speaking gigs aligned to the book. So that kind of goes to your past question about how did I get business. That also was a big, you know, big way people found out of me. Or not big, but you know what I mean. A major way.
Understood.
I need a fancier word, right? A major way people found out about me. So it's the same thing with the global market. I'm very fortunate not only to be associated with the Global Speakers Network at NSA, which I would encourage anybody interested in doing business overseas to attend the meetings or to get the newsletter or whatever. Because they have been out there. You know, you get the Brian Tracys and you got other people who are traveling all the time. who are learning a lot, because there's a lot to learn. I mean, everybody wants to travel.
Right.
And when my kids got out of the house, I decided now was the time that I wanted to open up opportunities to do that. So it was a nice confluence of forces. The book got translated into a number of different languages. I started doing webinars with Korea, Vietnam, and was able to then get some speaking gigs over there. What I will say is one of the things I learned, and I learned this on my trips this year, was that it's really great to partner with an organization, as you mentioned, an organization that's down in that country, who's going to support you. It's sort of like hard, you know how when we try to do public workshops over here?
Right.
I tried that with a speaking representative, and it just didn't go anywhere. And I think the reason the other ones went, I partnered with an organization called Leadership Western Australia, and then a university down in Paraguay. And what worked so well about that is that they marketed it, they hosted me, and it was just fantastic learning from both sides of the equation. So the book sort of opened the door, and then I was able to leverage that with these associations. Some of them actually contacted me. In other cases, I was going to a place and I asked people who they knew there. But I will say, too, it's a lot of work to speak globally. You really have to want to do it, but oh my gosh, it's what a great experience.
And I've never had the privilege of speaking internationally. Hopefully, I will get there. But I'm curious to know, in terms of translation, you know, just practically, when you're on the platform giving that speech, obviously, when you're speaking in your native tongue to a native audience, you know, that, of course, has its own challenges that I think we spend a lifetime trying to master.
Yes.
So I think when you go abroad and you're speaking to an audience who maybe, you know, there's a language barrier, certainly, you know, you raise the bar in terms of, you know, things that you have to deal with. So I'm curious to know, number one, if you had a translator, and if not, what is that experience like?
Well, when I was in Australia, I felt like I needed a translator. Seriously, some of those words, it took me about a week to kind of get in the hang. Then I went to the other part of the country, and it was like here. I couldn't understand anything. But I'll answer that question in two ways. There were and I learned this from my other colleagues who had been there. There's different options for a translation. And in one case, for instance, when I was in Vietnam, it was the kind of translation where I would speak and then the translator would speak. And I would speak. And it doesn't take you long to get the hang of that.
I've done that here. That was really tough.
Yeah, you've done that probably with hearing impaired. They do with the government, right?
Or
sign language.
And I've actually spoken to an Asian audience here. And, you know, I had a translator.
Was it hard for you?
Yeah, it was hard because, you know, I would say a very short sentence and the translation would be so long, you know, going back and forth.
Yes.
And of course, with speakers, it's all rhythm, or a lot is rhythm, you know, and just the energy that goes back and forth from the audience. And I think when you have an intermediary, it sort of breaks up that natural rhythm that you have. That was the biggest challenge that I had.
Absolutely. Yeah, that I was lucky with the translator I had. He had been a translator for many dignitaries, and he was also a very physical person.
Okay.
So, you know, and I'm very physical when I'm on the platform. So he, like, I jump and use my hands, and he would, I'm doing that
She's
now.
She's jumping right
and
now.
And I'm jumping right now. I wish we had a video. And then he would jump. He was really cute. And
right.
So we kind of had our own rhythm. So I think that, but it's the key that I learned is you got to get there before, even the day before, and go over all the slides and make sure they understand. In fact, in some cases, that one translator told me to change some things because they would be misinterpreted.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was key. Then I had a really cool experience in Paraguay. And I'm not name dropping this. All this great stuff just happened.
You've been there, done that. So
I know.
You deserve it.
Well,
let's hear it.
All right, whatever. What do they say? Don't brag on yourself when you're in the South. Don't brag on yourself.
If you've done it, then it's not bragging
book.
So you've done it, and we want to learn from you.
And
so
you're Southern, right?
So please share. Now I'm from Virginia.
Oh, you're from Virginia.
But I love the South.
Okay, I do too. I do too. Anyway, so bragging about Paraguay. So we're talking about Paraguay. And this translator, so this was a company that actually the university uses. And they had just like the UN, I mean, they had a little booth with these two women. And I had the headset, and I never had to stop or skip.
Okay.
They were amazing. And the laughter would come just a second after, or the applause, or the, you know, raised hands. And it took me about a few minutes, and then I was into the flow. So that was my simultaneous translation. That's what it's called.
Well, that's good.
But you know, it's all a learning experience. And, what happens is it just broadens you so much to speak outside of our country, you know?
In terms of, I guess, feedback that you get, do you notice, is it this thing where people are the same everywhere? So the introverts in Korea, for example, are the same as the introverts in the U.S., or is it because maybe the influence of their culture that, you know, they're needs, for lack of a better word, in terms of, you know, their introvert and what you provided for them? Was it different, or did you just basically do the same thing?
Well, I did. I've learned over the years to customize my program. So I found that it was different and the same, okay. You know, in many respects.
Gotcha.
Some of the concepts are the same, but if you know them, just like all of us should do, is customize against,
right.
You know, what's happening in their environment, in their culture. And in fact, in that case, they have to work a lot with some of those Asian countries, and Singapore too, when I was there, they have to work with Western companies. So
right.
They need to adapt to our style.
Understood.
So that's not as hard to talk about.
Understood.
You know? So, yeah.
Understood.
People are not all the same in every respect.
Right. Gotcha.
But they are very appreciative, I will say that. And they do, I could really see how you could almost get on an ego trip with being a speaker internationally. And
yeah.
I think some people might, because many countries love America.
Right. Right. So. And I think we have no problem doing that in this country as well. So that just adds to it a little
That's
bit.
That's true. That's true.
So two of your books, The Introverted Leader and Quiet Influence, talk to me a little bit about those in terms mm-hmm. of, I'm assuming that The Introverted Leader is your baby. I know you wrote your first book with your husband, but
yeah.
The Introverted Leader is sort of when you were in your lane officially,
yeah,
for lack
good way
of
to
a better
it.
Word.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, tell us a little bit about what that book is like and what the process was like coming to that, and just share a little bit about your baby.
Yeah,
and
my
her
baby.
Face is lighting up right now. If you could see her face,
yeah, she is
a huge smile.
Okay, yeah, it's funny that you say my baby. Yeah, well, when I was telling you about how I was trying to develop a niche and kind of figuring out when I was kind of floundering, all things to all people, I do one of the things I do when I'm stuck is I bring on either colleagues or paid help,
mm-hmm.
you know, to help me, and I brought on. A coach, and a lot of us know her in the speaking world, Sam Horn.
Yes.
Sam is brilliant.
Yes, he
and,
is.
And Sam helped me. We talked together about, you know, what made sense from my background,
mm-hmm.
and where the needs were. And there was nothing written for introverts in the workplace, believe it or not. So I had a chance to really claim that space.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we both read this article in USA Today the same day, because we're both news junkies. And I think I called her, or we emailed each other, and it's like, oh my God, that's it. Introverts are CEO. There are CEOs who are introverts. And had Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. And I was like, there's a need. This is everything I've been talking to you about, Sam. There's a book here.
Right.
So, and I wanted to write a book that was, again, more aligned to where I wanted to speak, how I wanted to speak and carve out my niche there.
Right.
And so, boy, it was a journey. It was really painstaking in some ways, but really fulfilling in others. And I typically use the same approach in my books. I do a lot of research through interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So I set out to interview introverted leaders and use a lot of the background that I had in leadership development, but really kind of tailor it
right.
to the needs that had bubbled up from the introverts I work with.
Okay. So how the sequel, Quiet Influence.
The sequel. Yeah. My publisher, who, by the way, is phenomenal, Barrett Kohler. If anybody wants to read great books, Barrett Kohler, B-E-R-R-E-T, T-T-K-O-E-H-L-E-R. They're an incredible organization. Their mission is create a world that works for all.
Mm-hmm.
And all the books have to be connected to that. They're out of San Francisco. Anyway, Barrett Kohler had, my publisher calls it a franchise now. He's like, yo, you're doing a franchise. But that's not really true. It's just the one thing leads to another. And
right.
And my community really talks to me. So I put the book out there. I happen to have always had an affinity for doing PR and kind of talking to people and getting word out and communicating with my readers. And so I started to hear from them. It wasn't just about leading, which the first book really focused on,
right.
emerging leaders.
Right.
And how do you kind of get to the next level? And how do you manage? And a lot of the basic fundamentals about leadership
right.
from an introvert perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you, and I put together a model called the 4 P's mm-hmm. that people found very user-friendly, like to prepare and to, you know, use your strengths,
right.
practice and all these things. So anyway, that did really well. The book came out. And then as I heard people, they said, you know, I want to lead, but I also am having trouble getting my ideas across the organization. I'm having trouble. I want to make a change, and I'm getting a lot of resistance. So I started to look at the concept of influence married to introverts. And that's where I came up with the idea of quiet influence and how do people make a difference without making a lot of noise.
Right. That's great. And I guess a Cliff Notes version for the speakers who are out there listening, there are a few things that you said that are kind of all coming together for me right now. In particular, one of the things that you said is listening to your community. So as speakers, I think it's important that you create that community and listen to what those people are saying. And then earlier on in our conversation, you said that the books complemented the speaking, and the speaking also complemented the books. And I think that's something very important for speakers to understand. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people underestimate the power of the book.
Yes.
And a lot of times the book is just the conversation starter, or it's that one thing that the person sees out there, and it gives you that credibility as the expert in this particular space, which could lead to the speech. Or, of course, if you get the speech first, then you have the book to go along with it.
Absolutely. So, they're symbiotic. You know, it goes together.
That's a beautiful word, by the way.
Well, I love how you put those those themes together. And as there are a lot of great people in our community who can help you write a good book.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just want to write a book to write a book, I don't think, right?
Right.
You want something that people can find useful.
Absolutely.
And we have so much talent and expertise in our community, in our speaker community. And we are all connected tangentially to other groups. Mm-hmm. So there's, you know, that would be another suggestion I would make, to really tap into that expertise. You know, whether you hire them, you know, I use Sam, and then I did other things working with a lot of other people to get their insights and ideas. And we all help each other.
Right. Well, before we close out here and get into some fun stuff to close out and talking about what's on the future for Dr. Konweiler, CSP, I'd like for you to share really quickly just some of the advantages of niching for speakers. I know that there are several sort of schools of thought, so a philosophy in the speaking world, where somewhere you kind of, you know, spread yourself as wide as possible and cover these areas as you did in the beginning of your mm-hmm. career. And then there's who say, you know, you have to have a laser focus in one particular area like you do with introverts right mm-hmm. now. And it seems like you've sort of went through that spectrum. And I know that everything is different for different folks, but just for the sake of time, would you mind sharing what are some of the advantages that you find from being extremely niched with a particular group?
Yeah, well, it's kind of counterintuitive, you know, mm-hmm. and that's where we think, well, if I niche, then I'm going to have to turn away opportunities. But right. in fact, I have found that the opposite is really true,
mm-hmm.
because you develop such competence and
right.
respect and knowledge in that area that you become the go-to person
right.
for that particular topic.
Right.
So when a speaker is, when a company or an organization is looking to hire somebody, you know, your name comes up among the top ones. And that's what you want. You want that. However, I will say that not everybody's ready to niche.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talked about, you know, I'm old. You know, I've been around for a while. And not that you have to wait till you're old. Old, I shouldn't say I'm old.
Let's call it
old,
seasoned.
Old, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Okay. My kids would call me old. But I think for what I'm doing, a program with my colleague Ghislaine LaBelle from CAPS at our NSA conference coming up, and she, Ghislaine and I, have a very similar experience with our success and how we, you know, we talk about how we quadrupled our incomes when we niched. But both of us have had experience, so I think it's something definitely to work towards.
Right.
But I think for me, what happens is when I'm speaking on introversion and a topic, I will also bring in a lot of the experience that I've collected along the way.
Right.
You know,
makes
doing
sense.
All these other things.
Right.
So I think that's a caveat to not maybe niche too early, or mm-hmm. before you feel like you're ready,
right.
you know, to stand up there and, you know, it's like being a consultant and not having any experience consulting.
Right, exactly.
Because you'll be asked about everything, right, when you're a speaker. It's mm-hmm. not, you're not just talking about that. So, but I think for me, it's been an amazingly successful approach,
yeah.
Particularly if you can marry a book with it.
Yeah, it sounds like when it comes to niching that it's a timing thing, you know, and you just have to know when the timing is right for you to niche or not to niche. And
yeah.
It's something that you'll learn as you go through your journey.
Exactly. And you can even niche in part way. You know,
right.
you can start to experiment with that and say, you know what, this is a specialty, like with Ryan, and we're using him as example, as millennials, mm-hmm. or whatever your topic is, you start to experiment, try that on. It's like a pilot.
Right.
You
Understood.
Know, without throwing everything else out. And let's see if I can get some traction around this. And then you start to see, yeah, people are responding. You know, they're into this. There's more material I can write about.
Right.
I can become the overused word thought leader.
Right. Makes
you know,
sense. Makes
in
sense.
This. So.
Well, I hate to bring this conversation to a close, but there are a couple of things that I want to ask you before I let you escape. So you said that you were a news junkie. So we want to get a little peek into your personality. I also follow the news, I must admit. And one of the things that I've been seeing a lot of lately is women in business and women in industry and women in empowerment. And so being that we opened the show talking about how you've pioneered, blazed a trail in this industry for women, and you're one of the first women when there were few women speakers or consultants in the room. What is your thought about this trend, and are you feeling that right now, and have you seen sort of that change or shift take place in the speaking industry? Because I'm sure there are a lot of young women looking to break into the speaking business.
Yes, yes, on all accounts. I see a change, but, you know, we've come a long way, baby, that expression from the 70s,
right.
Virginia Slims.
See, but Virginia, it's coming back.
There it comes. And it's smoking. We probably shouldn't even mention that. But we have, but we haven't, you know. And so, right. Like, for instance, the book Lean In, that's the talk of the town.
Right.
You know, let's face it, Des, is not a lot of new stuff. You know, we've all heard that before. However, when a young woman in a company says to me, you know what, my boss bought the book, I bought the book, and we're now meeting about it and talking about the concepts in there.
Right.
You know, to me, that's real change.
Absolutely.
Because before we'd have a book about that, and all the women would get together and read the book.
Right. And they would just sit there and collect dust. So at least we're taking another step
forward. I mean, it's slow. And the other thing that you and I have talked about is when you have people in positions of power, like NSA has several key positions filled with women as one example of an organization.
Right.
Then you're going to get representative viewpoints, diverse viewpoints.
Makes sense.
And so I think that's true in companies and nonprofits and everything. So as more women get into politics, and if we can, as now this whole theme about confidence, if we can get our confidence up there,
mm-hmm.
which is an internal job,
right?
You know, that's still, we got ways to go on that.
Right.
But I have two daughters, and I'm real proud of the kind of, you know, the chutzpah.
Right.
That they show.
Understood.
So, and I see that with a lot of young women today. So, hallelujah.
So, last question. NSA. We talked about the National mm-hmm. Speakers Association. I know it's been a wonderful organization for me for the nearly 5 years that I've been a part of it. You've been a part of it for much longer than I have. So, your last question is a softball question. And that question is, what gift would you say that the National Speakers Association, and in particular the Georgia chapter, or generally just the national organization, what gift has NSA given to you, and what word of advice, or why would you encourage a young aspiring speaker, or maybe a person who's listening and not yet a part of NSA, why would they want to join NSA, and how has it helped you rise to the mountaintop of speaking?
Oh, I like that. You know, as I think about both the local chapter, which you lead so brilliantly this year, I'm so happy with what's going on there. And I think about national, and all I can think is my involvement in those groups has really let me step into and believe into my role as a speaker. I own that now.
Right.
And I just do. I feel so happy about and proud about being a speaker because of the many gifts that I get from the people. Who
right.
are in the organization and who give and serve so willingly.
Yes. Well, thank you for that. And I would have to echo that comment. It's the relationships and the people who are, I now consider in my friend category because of this organization has grown tremendously. And they're there for you for business as well as personal. And I don't think that, you know, that's something that you could beat with a bet. So Jennifer Conweiler, Dr. Conweiler, CSP, we appreciate you taking the time to spend with us today on Speaking Insights. I know that you're a very busy woman. We appreciate the things that you've done for the speaking industry. We wish you continued success. And to all of our guests, we encourage you to tune in to another edition of Speaking Insights, and also to follow us on our website, which is www.nsageorgia.org. Until next time.